This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run.
Good morning.
Hello. Let's kick off the show with a look at the biggest news, of course, the fact that yesterday an early morning flight from Jakarta to Pangkal Pinang, a Lion Air flight, had crashed into the sea. It was just about 13 minutes after taking off. There was 189 people on board. So, grim news to start the day, unfortunately, but we are keeping an eye on any developments on this case.
Yeah, and Lion Air said in a statement that the pilot and co-pilot had had more than 11,000 flight hours between them. And if looking at the aircraft, this 737 MAX series, I mean, it is the fastest selling plane in Boeing's history, but this exact aircraft that was involved in the crash was made in 2018, this year itself.
Yeah, so it's so new. So it's, I mean, I think the question being asked now, guys, is that how could a brand new plane have crashed?
Mm. Yeah, and on top of that, just last year, you had this industry body called the Ascend Flight Global's Airline Safety and Losses. They proclaimed that last year, that the age of zero accidents is here, more or less. So let me repeat that, okay? Last year, 2017, they said, and I quote, the age of zero accidents is here, more or less. Well, guess what? This latest tragedy out of Indonesia just changes that entire narrative.
Well, I think last year there were no major airplane crashes, big aviation crashes. So I think that was largely, according to aviation experts, they say it's largely to technology, you know, better tracking, better ability to diagnose problems. I guess we're still waiting. Indonesian authorities have been quite tight-lipped about this, so we're not really hearing much about it. But according to a technical log obtained by the BBC, the airplane crashed shortly after takeoff. It had suffered instrument problems the day before. So a technical log from the flight showed that the instrument was unreliable and the pilot had had to hand over to the first officer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you are right there, Mel, because last year was the safest on record, right? No passenger fatalities involving jets with seats of 14 or more, so those bigger ones, right? But then this year, even at the start of the year, do you remember when 170 people were killed over about a month plus or so in three different incidents? And that was earlier this year. And then now you have this. Now, of course, industry insiders will still maintain the broader safety. I mean, these are the rarities, not the norms, right? I mean, you have a greater risk of getting, getting into a road accident, right? You know, so I understand that, but then you can't help but think, you know, given all these headlines that are being aimed at you and all the pictures that are coming out from this story here, right? It does, give you pause.
Yeah. I have to say it resonates with us particularly because it just brings back all that memories from MH370, right? Because when I saw, I got a news update on my phone, one of those push alerts, and I saw this and I had a moment of flashback to MH370. And I think that's why all the papers today are covering this as their main story. I mean, not just is Indonesia is our neighbor, but there's a certain resonance with us because of, what we went through with MH370.
Yeah. And I think when news first broke at first, some headlines was that the plane is missing. Like they couldn't find a plane at first. Yeah.
And since then, there was obviously MH17 and then that Air Asia crash or so a few months after that.
Indonesia.
Yeah.
Right, guys, on in other news, please break out your checkbooks because Equanimity, the super yacht, has gone up for auction. It's the first sale of a major asset that was seized by authorities investigating 1MDB. So Jolo bought Equanimity, I think, for $250 million. But right now, the appraised value for the super yacht will only be closed after the bidding process is over at the end of November.
Yeah.
Joyce, how much are you going to be making?
Well, coming from Penang, looking at this vessel, right, it can accommodate up to 22 guests and 31 crew. And it actually has a swimming pool, a beauty salon, a massage room, sauna, helipad. to name a few, you know, quite interesting. And they also have a movie theater as well as a Turkish bar.
Don't forget that. I think it was marble floors and there were gold trimmings. Mm. I remember, you know, all the trimmings of that.
Maybe Han can buy it and then we can be guests.
And he can, okay.
Yeah, he can totally. Invite us on because it can fit up to 22 guests.
Yeah, sure. In your dreams. Yeah, how about that? Look, it is a missed opportunity. You know, I wish that I could have gotten, you know, at least one trip.
Did you get to see it it was birthed at?
No, remember like when it was first seized from Indonesian waters, we were talking about this, mm-hmm. how, you know, we could make this a tourist attraction. I think there was some commentary in the lead up to G14 as well. It's okay, hey, you know, we can all go take rides on Equanimity. But now, maybe not.
Well, we'll find out how much is going to be sold for at the end of November. It's 6 minutes past 6 o'clock. And after this, we're going to be looking at what Malaysia can do to better market local experiences. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9 is coming up to 10 minutes past 6 o'clock. You're listening to The Morning Run with Joyce Han and me, Mel. That was Otis Redding with Day Tripper. Now, the UNESCO Jakarta Cultural Unit has said that managers of World Heritage Sites should focus on selling experiences of the local cultures and arts so that tourists will keep returning to visit. So the idea is that what visitors want now are experiences, and they want authentic experiences. So they want to live like locals. They want to immerse themselves in local culture and, you know, eat local food, see local sites. And that's why the UNESCO is now arguing that heritage conservation and sustainable tourism is not just about preserving these kind of brick and mortar buildings, but more about preserving the local culture and getting the local communities involved.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I mean, to go on these experiences, because sometimes as a tourist, now I think the whole, when you travel right now, is no longer joining a tour group. You know, waking up early and then just go see the site, take a photo, and then that's it. You know, mm-hmm. it's all about immersing yourself in the local experience. I can imagine in Penang, you can have a walking food trail, you know?
Yeah, I love those. Yeah. I love walking. So whenever I go somewhere new, I almost always join a walking food tour.
Same.
So that you can walk it and then, you know, see the local sites. And then there's always a local tour guide who gives you kind of context, right?
Right.
It's not in a microphone. It's not carrying an umbrella.
Yeah, with the wear flag and follow the sticker.
It's very local, and they take you to where the locals eat.
That's right.
Right.
And I think it's just the local experience. We did, my husband and I did a Vespa tour before as well.
That's so cute.
Yeah, I'm kind of preferring the Vespa tour than the walking tour. Can you have the food tour without the walking? I mean, I think
that's when you walk off the food, right?
We're on a holiday. You know, you're not supposed to exercise. But yeah, you know, Malaysia might be onto something here, because I was reading this story recently about how, you know, their couples are getting married in India. Mm-hmm. And guess what? To sell that experience, they're selling tickets to their own weddings.
Yeah, I kid
you
not.
Yeah, so tourists.
Tickets.
Yeah.
Yeah, to their wedding.
I know. Oh, here's an idea for you, Melissa Idris. But anyways, so the idea is that you offer these tourists the chance to experience an authentic Indian wedding. And then at the same time, you cover the cost for your wedding expenses also. Yeah.
But then you'll have like a bunch of random strangers.
So this was a couple.
Photos.
This was a couple. A tourist, a couple that went, and uh-huh. they enjoyed it. I think, and the bride and groom was happy to. They were happy to have them on their wedding to experience the whole local wedding, the local culture.
That's true. Yeah. Okay, actually, so if you didn't sell tickets, could you just go gate crash a wedding? Because I have seen. I know some of the weddings that are at temples. You're walking past, and you just kind of pop in and have a look, and you can witness the whole ceremony. They weren't selling tickets, but you know, it was open to the public.
Are you speaking from experience?
Well, that's called intruding, right?
You know?
Yeah, perhaps in some countries that might be, you know, punishable by jail or something.
So what else can, like, I guess, heritage sites or states and tourism councils
I think,
do to sell these experiences?
Cooking tours as well, like local cooking tours. I think I'll enjoy that. I did one in Malacca, and my family and I, we enjoyed that.
Whole
learning to cook. What dish did we learn? We learned how to cook terung, with it's a kind of like...
You should come back to my mom's house. Yeah. Wait, she'll teach you how to do that.
Taichung is brinjal, right?
Yeah, brinjal. Yeah.
Eggplant,
yeah.
Aubergine, yeah. Eggplant, all that.
Yeah. Well, okay, so when I look at these kind of stories, right, you know, I'm a little bit cautious because, you know, it tends to get quite formulaic. It tends to get, you know, quite plastic, right? When it comes to like these top-down, oh, you know, here are some state-sponsored experiences, right? As opposed to something that's organic, I'm more inclined towards finding my own experiences. So I'll give an example. I was in New Zealand and I was traveling around and I went to one of those Maori shows and it's part of the experience thing, you know. And they even did the whole greeting where like this big guy comes up to you and like touches his nose to your nose. It was quite intimidating, right? But at the end of it all, I was like, well, I paid that much money and it didn't feel real. It felt very put on, right?
But it's a show, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a show and it was part of like you experience the Maori food and you know, life in the village, you know, like the whole 9 years.
So how do you keep it authentic? That's the question.
Do you think personalize? Well, keep it small?
Well, no, I think not. Not just that. I think it's, I mean, facilitating it, but also allowing people to go on their own adventures. I think that is key, you know, at least for me.
Well, what UNESCO is saying is that you get the local communities involved, and that's how you keep it authentic, making sure that you're not just preserving the old buildings, but you're preserving the old way of life so you can integrate. So you know how they have like those homestays?
Yeah, right? Homestays. Yeah. Coming back to the cooking, it was a Chris Tung food culture tour that I went on. It's a Malaccan Portuguese food, local food, Kristang.
Okay, yeah. But I'm thinking about this, right? So, you know, when this grows to scale, the idea is that you got to cater to the tourist's taste buds, right? It's not going to be perhaps less authentic, right? And because you see that with the Pasar Malams or, you know, all these markets around Bangkok, you're in here in Malaysia, like they keep sending the same stuff over
but
and over again.
It can be so many things, Han. I'm thinking to myself as a tourist, I would, you know, love to experience the local, I guess, culture in terms of having tourists go and tanam padi or, you know what I mean? Like involved.
You know,
okay.
You could bring them to a durian plantation farm or sort. So bring them to a local market and teach them, like for Penang, you teach them how to bargain.
Yeah.
because that is...
At the Pasar Malam.
That is local community. Authentic.
I mean, again, I see the appeal of the niche right there, but the word there was scale, right? So as you then scale up, then what happens? And then it becomes this formulaic, you know, experience, so to speak. You know? And I tend to like the authentic stuff.
Tell us what you think. How would you advise all these tourism councils to better market the local experience? 018-789-8899 is our WhatsApp number, or tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we're going to be looking at self-driving cars and whether or not they should have ethics. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 621 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run. Melissa, Han and Joyce here with you. Joyce there dancing to John Mayer here in the studio. That was New Light, the latest single from John Mayer. And we're taking a look at autonomous vehicles, which will drive our seats in the not too distant future. These cars will need to make split second decisions to avoid endangering human lives, both inside and outside the vehicle. So recently, a group of researchers created, I guess, a variation of the classic philosophical exercise called the trolley dilemma. So they created this game, I guess, to determine whether an autonomous car, self-driving car, should have ethics, essentially. What would be the attitudes of autonomous vehicles, right? So, for instance, should an autonomous vehicle, a self-driving car, swerve to avoid a group of pedestrians, killing the people in the car? Or should the autonomous car then kill the people on foot and then save the driver or save the passengers within the car? So how do you determine that? And what happens if, say, the pedestrians are children? Or what if it's an animal? So all these things, I think, come into play. Apparently, there was this website called The Moral Machine that these researchers built, and it's gone viral. So people are now using this as a way to determine whether autonomous vehicles should have ethics.
Well, what the researchers found was a series of near-universal preferences regarding regardless of where someone was taking the quiz. So on aggregate, I think people everywhere believe that the moral thing for a car to do was to spare the young over the old.
Okay, so if it's a kid, swerve to avoid the kid, but then hit the old person.
Yeah, spare humans over animals.
Okay.
And spare the lives of many over the few.
Right. Mm. So that's the, I guess, the guidelines that
the new universal preferences.
But how do you, I mean, this is really difficult because if you're a programmer for self-driving cars, how do you program this into, you know, into the chip, the memory, right?
Yeah, well, I guess that is a question for the folks over there at MIT. But then, if this is successfully implemented into AI or into these cars, right? My worry is that then it blurs the lines between robots and humans, right? Because what makes us human? Well, not just the emotions, but also the ability to empathize, for example, and not, just think in binary terms, not just ones and zeros. You can make these vague judgment or moral calls, so to speak, right? So I'm not too fussed about how they're going to do it, you know, but whether they should do it and perhaps risk blurring the lines between machine and man.
Wait a minute. So you're saying you don't want self-driving cars in the future, because self-driving car means that you're sitting in the back seat, right? You're not kind of alert or paying attention to driving. So when it comes to these split-second decisions, you're trusting the machine to make these decisions for you.
Yeah, well, so I'm going through this judging quiz that they're doing right now on it's moralmachine.mit.edu. You can go check it out. So again, it's moralmachine.mit.edu. I'm 3 questions into the 13 or so. Hopefully I can get this done in the next 2 minutes and I'll give you the results.
Tell us how it scored you.
Yeah.
Well, I personally feel, I have no issues driving myself. It's quite scary though. I don't know, because maybe it's new. It's the unknown, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, it's more of that you don't know what to expect and whether or not you can trust a machine to drive the car.
So I recently spoke to an AI, the world's most valuable AI startup is actually in China. It's called SenseTime. It was on The Breakfast Grill. And they said this is a mindset issue for our generation. But for our kids' generation, generations after that, who grew up as digital natives, this will not be an issue. So your kids will sit into an autonomous car without thinking twice. But we may have those kinds of reservations.
Right. And then there's also who do you assign blame to, right? You know, because if, let's say, one of these scenarios, however you look at it, you know, if leads to fatalities, ultimately, who gets the blame? Can you blame a machine that has ethics?
Mm. And what if the machine goes rogue?
All right, well, we'll come back and see how Han did on that, was it moralmachine.mit? Is that right?
Yes, okay. .edu.
All right, then we've got the 6:30 News Bulletin brought to you by Sabrina Magdalene next, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9 is coming up to 6:40 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. You're listening to The Morning Run. That was Frederick by Patti Smith there. And thank you guys for your messages this morning. 018-789-8899 is our number, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We have a message from Ro Wing in on the conversation a little bit earlier about autonomous vehicles and whether they should have ethics, right? So Han has been doing the ethics questionnaire that researchers have built on this website called moralmachine.mit.edu. But let me just quickly read a couple of messages. We have a message from Ro who says, not quite sure why we need self-driving cars where most cars are already, in air quotes, self-driving while the drivers are on their mobile phones. We are not condoning that kind of behavior here on The Morning Run, Ro. Just to let you know, everyone, drive safe, hands off those mobile phones.
We also have a WhatsApp from Mohan who says that he doesn't agree that humans should be spared over animals because the animals did no wrong.
Okay, well, that is very different from the results that I got on this Moral Machine. Again, you can go and check this out, moralmachine.mit.edu. I will spare myself from the humiliation of revealing some of the more damning results, okay? But ladies, you would like to know that I have a greater propensity for saving females over the average results from this test. So that's one. When it comes to species preference, I'm totally for humans. Sorry, they're animals. They get the short end of the stick there. But then when it comes to, this is a funny one, when it comes to fitter people, I am all for fitter saving those who are fit and large people not so much.
Oh my goodness.
I didn't even realize that was a thing in the survey.
Discrimination. So I know. This is showing Hans' bias, right?
I'm discriminating against myself. Because so, I've let myself go. It's like, well, I don't deserve to live.
So the self-driving car could likely hit you and save someone fitter. Oh no, Han. No. All right, well, tell us what you think. Again, we'd love to hear from you. Join the conversation this morning. We're keeping, I guess, one thing that caught our interest over the weekend had been the news about schools introducing e-textbooks for next year. So this was a surprise announcement by the Deputy Education Minister, but is it an unwelcome one? What do you guys think? Joyce, you're a parent?
Well, for me, I feel that this is more external changes. What about internal? Look at the syllabus. Do something about the whole education system. This whole digital textbooks, I don't know whether that's going to work for me, to be honest. I know we're moving with the times and all that, but how much is it going to cost and how are they going to roll that out? I mean, it's great that we're keeping with the times, but we have to really look at the pros and cons of having that. To me, I still prefer reading a book, but
so
I'm old-fashioned.
This is a PDF copy, right? Mm-hmm. So I think this is addressing the fact that some of the school kids, the bags are really heavy because these textbooks can be quite thick and heavy. So addressing that issue, my question is, what are the kids going to read it on?
Well,
like, is that going to be a tablet?
Tablet.
Are all kids going to need a tablet?
Well, so there we go, right? The economics of this proposal, I think that is being a question right now. So, I mean, until they can get that sorted out, really, this is just, something that's academic, really. I mean, they're just trying to mull this idea.
But they said next year, you know?
Oh, is it?
Yeah, they said,
but it's for select schools, right?
Correct. Okay, that's a good point. So it's undeniable that they have to start somewhere. Digital textbooks, they say, are the way to go. And they're going to work with parent teacher associations and private companies to equip select schools with computers. So I guess, looking at, for me, whenever they say they're going to work with private companies, that raises, I guess, certain alarm bells or red flags, given that we've seen previous such programs like these not work before or open to abuse and leakages.
Yeah, this is a story in the Star that talks about this this move to e-textbooks, and they shared on how one of the cheapest options are tablets, and which can be bought for about five. The lowest is about 500 ringgit, and it comes with 7-inch screen, a 16 GB storage.
Right.
So at the end of the day, you still have to fork out 500 ringgit to get your kid a device to read that e-textbook.
Yeah, so once again, the economics of it, right? But then also the practicality, because with the textbooks, you either have it or you don't, right? Whereas with these electronic devices, then you run into a whole host of technical issues as well.
Well, okay, so can I just, to think about the pros of this, right? So we've been talking a bit about the cons, the implementation, problems that could run, that the authorities could face when it comes to rolling this out. But the pros of it is, at some point in the future, all children will need to be computer literate, right? Mm-hmm. So why not start now? Why not equip them now and have them just get used to, they're already born as digital natives. If there is a way for us to get computers for every child equal opportunity, wouldn't this be, a step in the right direction?
Well, for me, maybe they could have computer classes, but when it comes with e-textbooks, then writing and when it comes to learning to write, or would they write less? I don't know, it's just a question off the top of my head.
I do. Don't write anymore. Yeah. So forget about
it. So as long
as
you know how to write, read and write, shouldn't you also know how to type and, use the touch
screen? Computer.
Well, so based on the comments that I've seen on these, parent Facebook groups and education Facebook groups, the fear is that, given now when you hand a kid a screen, all they want to do is just play games, right? Then you start blurring the lines between game and work, and they might not gravitate to something that's more serious, and they're just use the tablets to play games.
And we're trying to cut their screen time as well.
Well, apparently this is for secondary schools first. So, not young children. They're essentially older and can have agency, essentially. So secondary schools, perhaps a better way to roll this out. We have a message here from Mohan who says that why e-textbooks? Because why not have lockers at schools, right?
So that's a good point. We used to have lockers in my school. Yeah, we used to have lockers where
your school is my school. Yeah, just went to the same school. Yeah.
And we used to have lockers.
All right, okay, 6:40, coming up to 6:47 right now. We'll be back with more with The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:51 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run, Joyce Hun and me, Mel, here with you. California Soul by Marlena Shaw there. Now, thank you for your messages. We've got loads of, messages, comments, thoughts coming in on WhatsApp and Twitter. My number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Wait, that's not my number. That is the BFM number. Please don't send me photos. The BFM number is 018-789-8899. All right. Okay. Talking about self-driving cars having ethics, we have a couple of messages here. We have a message from, I believe this is Zikri on Twitter. He's saying the first rule is safety of riders inside the autonomous car over everyone else, not the other way around.
So then my pushback will be, you know, would you say the same thing if, let's say, you and your family were in the path of that self or that runaway self-driving vehicle? Tough one.
Okay. All right, we also have a message from Peter Tan on WhatsApp.
He said that the software engineers should ensure the self-driving cars are able to avoid mud run pits.
and everyone else as well, but it's tough with mud run pits as well, right? All right, we also have a couple of messages coming in on the news or the proposal to introduce e-textbooks next year for secondary school students. Now, looking at WhatsApp and Twitter, we have a couple of messages. I think Ramli Syrup, which is a great handle on Twitter, he's saying that e-textbooks are a great idea. Kids are always begging for gadgets now. It can be educational too. So almost every parent has a mobile phone, a bit small, but good enough to begin with.
Well, we have this tweet coming in from Izzat Rahim saying that digital text is only good for supplementary materials, not the entire textbook. Attention span, flexibility, you know, these are all concerns. That's true, I agree. And also Victor Liu says that being digital natives, they don't need the screen time anymore. They need more analog lives. Who is getting the ebook contract?
That is the big question, right? Who will be getting that ebook contract or the tablet contract?
And I totally agree with Izzat here. Look, as a tutor myself, in my classes, they have those textbooks and they also have their phones with them. I actually have to make sure the kids actually have their phones with them. So if you want to look up supplementary material, or I can send them story links via WhatsApp, I can do that. Because can you imagine trying to read a 300-500 page textbook all via PDF? It's going to be really tough, really, really tough on the eyes there. I mean, some of the concerns from parents is that it could strain the eyesight of their children, right? So I think that is a major concern there. Maybe I'm just old school. I'm not used to reading 300-500 pages. And that's for one subject,
Guys, we have to think differently. You're absolutely right. You are old school. We have to. This is the younger generation. They're born with this.
But their eyes are the same.
They don't have the same hang-ups we have about touching paper. Paper and writing, and I have a WhatsApp message here from Daniel, which is wonderful. He's saying that that best like ebooks because cannot chunting and cannot highlight.
True.
That's great, because that's how you doodle. But a lot of children now and a lot of adults too read on ebooks, and it's no biggie. You can still highlight stuff.
But as a parent, for me, I'm trying to cut down the screen time of my kids. I'm trying to kind of cap their screen time. And if they
go, but what if the screen time was educational?
Even that. For me personally, I feel that, it's good, it's educational, but even that, I feel that it's good to just cut screen time. I don't know whether it's an old school thing, but that's just me.
No, so I had a bit more nuance with that, right? So screen time can be beneficial. Yeah. And can be used for entertainment as well. But right now, kids gravitate towards just games, right? That's the idea. So for me, what I teach these kids is that, look, you can use these phones, but guess what? You can use it to look up information as well. You can read stuff that's beneficial. It's not all about games. Ultimately, the message I'm trying to send there is be good digital citizens. You develop those good habits. You develop some discipline as well. Not everything has to be Angry Birds. Is that even a thing anymore?
Okay. No. Okay, get with the times.
Paw Patrol.
For secondary school students, guys, just take a look at how we live our lives. We are so digital. Everything we do is with the laptop screen, right? Yeah. The three of us here, we don't have any papers in the studio. It's all laptop screens. Why not teach younger kids, secondary school kids, I might add, to adopt this kind of lifestyle, because this is just the trend of the way things are going to pan out in the future.
No, I mean, again, I get it. So, but those
it's
same
not entirely, right? Yeah. Maybe supplemented.
Yeah, right, exactly. Mm. So, you know, I'm saying it's supplementary, but ultimately, the point I was making earlier this morning was the economics of it all, because ultimately, this could be a cost or a burden on taxpayers as well. Mm-hmm. No? Sure. So, should we go down that route?
Mm. Well, Sui Chuan Ku on WhatsApp, on Twitter, saying, why not use Kindle-like devices, so minimum distraction, so you don't have all the angry
the
birds.
A Paw Patrol.
How much is that going to cost, though?
Yeah, that's true. Mm. I mean, that cost will definitely be an issue. All right, send us your messages. 018-789-8899 is the BFM number to send them in, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got Two Door Cinema Club coming up next with Something Good Can Work. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.